Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, at least the second hour of the episode, of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. You know, I sound kind of like one of those internet radio things that work on my cell phone that if it loses contact, it just repeats the last phrase, and so it repeats itself redundantly. All over again.
You're repetitive and redundant?
Yes, I'm repeatedly, repetitively redundant all over again.
Mm.
Yeah, it's like deja vu all over again. So you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach. You can give us a call at 773-1400. Local area code, of course, is 254-773-1400. Theoretically, at least, the phone works. It's not a phone system anymore. It is a phone, which we believe that the engineers here at KTEM probably stole from the Smithsonian Institution, something like that. But you can give us a call if you like. Now, last hour we had a question, we were asked to make a comment about something.
Yes, the
education system.
Yes,
It stinks,
and we've got.
Okay, that was it. We can move on to another.
All right. Really at the root of the issue that we're looking at here with education is whether or not vouchers are a good idea, the impact that they'll have on the current schools, and what they'll do as far as long-term planning and quality of education. This is something, listeners, I did a whole episode on education a couple of months back, where I talked about a lot of the factors that I look at when we're measuring big socioeconomic groupings, whether it's a company all the way up to a country, whether it's a state or a municipality. One of the things we look at is the United States has one, maybe on par with Britain, but as far as quantity on top of quality, we are by far the leader in the upper education world. Of the top 100 universities, 85 of them are in the United States and 15 of them are in the UK. There's nobody else in the top 100. So any one of those 15 you could put head to head against any one of the 85, and one or the other may win. But the reality is that we have a fantastic the product that we have is fantastic. Is not even big enough a word. We have an amazing quality to our upper education.
And let me give you a little bit of a hint as to something I know about that, at least experienced. Why are the 85 and 15 in the UK and Great Britain? And it's largely because, and this is one of those things that may upset some people, they're privately funded. Now, the government may loan money to students to go there, but most of the money that's there is either from their endowment or from people paying to go to school there.
Yeah.
You would expect Germany to have a really, really, really first-class, what we call secondary education system, the university system. It doesn't.
I just call it upper education. That's a better, easier way.
The problem in Germany is in the ninth grade, at the end of the ninth grade, there's a test, and it determines whether you're going to wind up going to a university are going into work training. And so then for the equivalent of 10th and 11th, 12th grade are university prep. And then most of those kids go on to the university paid for by the government. So when we say, like in the state of Texas, we say Texas State University, and yes, it is a little fund. It is funded to some degree by the state of Texas. In Germany, it would be 100% funded by the state of Texas, which is a Bernie Sanders sort of idea.
Or Hillary Clinton picked it up at the end of the race there after Bernie Sanders said, I'll support you if.
But the point is, there's this tremendous – in the same trade-off, and you were going to get to this, I'm sure, we look down at our high school system and our elementary school system, and we see that it is a governmentally run system. And where do we stand in the world on our public school systems?
Very low.
So
extremely low. And what you're hitting is the point that I'm getting to exactly, is that our K through 12, which is not the way the rest of the world goes about it. Everybody's got their own way of doing that level of education. What year goes where? Our whole system is still designed on the advice given by Henry Ford in the 1920s and in the 19-teens, where he came in and he said, after being successful all the way up through the Great Depression, this is the input that we need so that we can get people working on the industrial lines. Mm-hmm. Well, the big thing that we talked about last hour, we're talking about manufacturing, and we talk about this regularly. Manufacturing jobs are going to be done by robots. We need to teach kids how to learn, not teach kids how to memorize. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that I could argue back and forth over the picks that the Trump administration is doing. There are some nuances that I would argue. Betsy DeVos is the education secretary.
I think it's DeVos.
DeVos. Betsy DeVos.
Of the Amway family.
Okay. She is a big proponent of school vouchers. She believes that people should have school vouchers that you could take to go to a public school or a private school. I have some problems with all of the above, vouchers or public. I think vouchers are a good first step, but something that needs to be very, very well understood is that no secretary, no head of a department, the Treasury or Justice or any other department can change the law.
Mm-hmm.
So school vouchers are not the law. There's a lot of people that are upset that she's going to come in and suddenly start throwing in vouchers and that it's going to directly impact the public school system. Next step, if we get the law changed and the vouchers are out there for people to use as they see fit, that's going to have a negative impact on the public school. So there are people with concerns about that. It's probably going to have a positive impact on the education system. But if your kids are in the public school system and the vouchers come out and you have a good competitive base with high quality schools out there, eventually we're going to have really high quality schools because they'll be competing against each other to say who's the best.
One of the things I think we really need to understand, and a lot of people are very concerned about this, but let's come down, let's lower the intensity a little bit. Betsy DeVos, as the Secretary of Education, or even the United States Congress, has a very, very limited impact on what happens in a public school. Now, the No Child Left Behind law had a big one, because schools get federal aid, and a law can be passed that can change that. But whether or not there are vouchers or not vouchers, and whether a voucher system is set up, is typically the business of the local school district.
No, it's
to a lesser
the state.
Extent.
It's the state.
Well, let me give you an example. In Austin, you've got a lot of charter schools, and Killeen, you don't.
That right. Those aren't vouchers, though. Each of those is funded in the same way, the same dollar,
right.
And it's done through the school district.
The point I want to make is that Betsy DeVos is also a great fan of charter schools.
That's correct.
And it's a matter of a difference in philosophy here. She has also stated in her press release when she was announced as the nominee that her goal is to raise the quality of education in the inner city schools. So that a kid in the inner city school will have the same educational opportunity and the same quality of education as, for example, we see in the state of Connecticut, which, by the way, happens to be the per capita richest state in the United States. And as a result, they have some really knockout public schools that are roughly the equivalent of private schools, because if you're not fairly well off, you can't afford to live in Connecticut. And, you know, so the point is that there's a difference in philosophy as to whether the school should be set up, and I hate to use this loaded word, but I'm going to, on a socialist system where are all run exactly the same way and the teachers all get the same pay and the education system is the same for everybody, or whether there should be an element of free enterprise and choice enter into the school system. In fact, there is some degree of free enterprise and choice. If a person is really, really wealthy and they want to have their kids get a really good education, they can move to Connecticut. On the other hand, I don't think you'd want to live in lower Louisiana if you want your kids to get a good public school education.
And even Connecticut has issues. The issues are that the standards used, there's, you know, the standardized test concept is there in every district.
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter if you're a charter or not, in order to get aid from the federal government, you've got to do these standardized tests. The concept behind the voucher is to allow the free market to have its hand in it once more. Now, here's something that we've got to say right at the beginning. I hope that all of the listeners, and I know everybody in this room, believe that it's important.
All both of us
believe it is vital, important to the well-being of our economy that all kids get an education.
A good education.
And that the way to pay for that, because some people will not pay for their own children's education.
Or can't. Or,
well, by that I mean will not, because they cannot. The will mm-hmm. is not a statement of intent. It's just a statement of they cannot do it, so they will not do it. If we do not provide for the education of the children, then we can't expect to hire people mm-hmm. later. We can't expect people to grow up and hire other people later.
Yes.
So each of – I mean, the American dream is very clear. The American dream says that no matter where you come from in America or anywhere else, coming to America gives you opportunities. All those opportunities are wasted without the know-how to get you through the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a statement. Now, we have decided, just like we have with healthcare, and most of our listeners, even people that really dislike the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, everybody that I speak to – what?
They're now calling it the Unaffordable Care Act.
Right, the Unaffordable Care Act. Everyone that I've spoken to is in agreement on one subject. If you show up at an emergency room and you don't have your wallet because for whatever reason it's not in your pocket. Maybe it got blown out of your pocket in the hang gliding accident. Who knows? Well, something happened. You show up at the emergency room or an ambulance shows up to pick you up.
They don't run a credit check.
No, they don't say, how are you going to pay for this? They don't wake you up from your unconscious state to slap you in the face and say, we need some money. They do in China. In a socialist world in China, they do. We have a socialist form of medicine. Now, we're expected to pay for it. We get bills. We say but a lot of those bills don't get paid. It is an ad hoc socialist system. We've agreed that we're not going to stop from saving someone's life because they can't pay for it. We've also agreed that if you've worked long enough and paid into the system long enough, you get to have a retirement on the government. These are all socialist things. I have no problem with them at the surface. When they go too far and they take away our incentive to innovate and to be creative, I have a major problem with it. And our K-12 education system now is at that point where all you have to do if you're a smart kid is you just coast through school. The challenges are there if you go out and find them, but you're not being challenged individually to go and do it because that's not part of a standardized system. We need to customize our school system to challenge our brightest as well as our dimmest. And I realize that that was a totally un-PC thing to say, but if we're going to call a smart kid bright and the other people are being left behind – we don't want to leave people behind either. We want to challenge every student to be the best that they can be. We're not doing that now. We're challenging the ones that are being left behind, and we're not doing a really good job doing that.
And we have a school, we have a public school system that needs a complete reform. And I say that because I can't remember. I'm really trying to remember the name of the guy who basically created the system we have today. There's an insurance company named after him that sells insurance to teachers, and I can't remember it. But in the 1920s. But the objective was to train children on farms how to enter the industrial workforce. Jake referred to that earlier, which is why we have this 3-month break in the summertime so the kids can go work on the farms. And I realize that it's very awkward to start to change anything. Parents have scheduled their vacations and lots of things during the summer so that they can, because that's when the kids get off, and it becomes very, very awkward to try to go to a year-round system. But you got to think about something. Here we have an education system, just the buildings. We can grasp the buildings very quickly. That's set empty or nearly empty 3 months out of the year. But we invest a tremendous amount of money, and we pay the teachers for 12 months because they can't go hungry for 3 months to work for 9 months.
Right. And with the problem that you said right there about scheduling vacations, it doesn't work on a factory. If you've got a factory and there's one person for every spot in the factory, and one of those people goes on vacation, if there's nobody to replace them while they're gone, well, you can't go on vacation. Sorry. That's not how it works. We've got a caller coming in. Let me finish this point, then we'll get to you, caller. So we'll get to you very shortly, caller.
Are they ringing?
No, it was.
Okay.
Now they're over on the other system.
Okay.
If we truly customize our education system, and there's ways of doing this. I know we've been studying it. We're in the process of founding a school. There are ways to customize the learning around each child. There are ways then that child can take a vacation when the parents decide to take the time off work, not in the summer, or it's open to whatever time, because it isn't the whole class learning the same subject at the same time. And if you're gone for 2 weeks, you've just missed everything, and now you got to catch up with the class. Each student is challenged at their own pace. That's the concept. You know, if you buy a computer right now, you go out and you find the computer that fits you. If you go to an upper education institution, you don't learn the same thing as everybody else at the upper education institution. You learn what you have decided will be best for you. When we're talking about the school system, the teachers have their hands tied. And this is something, talking to the teachers is the first place that you will hear how ineffective the school system is. And they are trying hard and they're doing their best. And the quality that we get is due to them, not due to the laws around it. The teachers are the heroes here. They're working as hard as they can, and they've got conflicting standards to meet. We got to fix this. And this particular Secretary of Education may not be the person to do it.
I don't know. She's,
but she might be the one to do it.
Yeah, the alternative, which we had under the Obama administration,
is the same old, same old.
Was a Secretary of Education that says if we rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, maybe it won't sink.
Right. There's a big hole in the hull. And we've got a caller waiting for us on 773-1400. Caller, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
I guess we don't have a caller.
Yeah, probably
went away. I don't know if they can even hear us once they go to that.
Yeah, they can.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a fundamental problem in the education system, extremely fundamental, and we are not quite at the crisis point yet, but it needs to be addressed, and it could be, who knows? Let's give Betsy DeVos a shot at it and see if she can figure out some way to fix it.
All right, caller. Now we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Same caller. I hung up. You answered just as I was hanging up.
I didn't
think it was working. Anyway, Horace Mann is the guy. I think you're
Horace Mann. Up. That's the guy. Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
And go
ahead.
What's amazing to me is this guy in the 1920s, beginning of the 20th century, writes and speaks on this issue. And he obviously is designing a school system not for the 21st century, but for the beginning of the 20th century. And if you look at the school system he envisioned to get kids off the farm and into the industrial workplace, get them to work for General Motors or Ford or something, and you look at the school system we have today, you'd just be amazed. We've got the school system Horace Mann designed.
Right.
But the industry is going away.
And what I will tell you right now is that he designed the best school system for that age group in the world at that time.
Yes.
We led the world. This is why we had the boom that we had. The Industrial Revolution happened in great part because of this new education system.
Well, that Industrial Revolution.
That Industrial
there
Education.
There was another one a century before.
Right. We'll this the newer one with the,
yeah.
Yes.
And we're having another one right now. We're having what's called a digital revolution.
I would even call it a digital industrial revolution.
Right.
The fact that the robots are doing it shouldn't mean it's less of a revolution.
But and there's a completely different set of skills needed, and kids are not working on the farm in the summertime. But we're trying to take the same institution, which is thoroughly broken, and tweak it a little bit to make it work.
I would say it's not broken. It's doing exactly what it was intended to do.
Well, right.
But it's not meeting the now. It's like trying to use a hammer to clean a window.
Yeah, it's like saying that the best way to get across the Atlantic Ocean is a sailing ship.
Right. It may, you could do it. It'll do what it's designed to do.
Sometimes.
But it's,
unless you get a hurricane or something.
Right. It may not be the best way of doing it today.
Yeah. And that's, you know, we've got to institutions.
By it may not. I mean, it isn't.
We're great fans of Douglas North and institutional economics. And he said that institutions start off as organizations designed to benefit their beneficiaries, the students in this case. And they gradually evolve into institutions that are designed to benefit their decision makers. So one of the big issues in the debate in Oklahoma that's come up, where they've gone to 4-day school weeks and they're not getting a lot of teaching done because of budgetary restraints. Former Governor Keating of Oklahoma was on the radio this week, and he said one of the biggest problems is that if you increase the funding for the schools, between 60% and 80% of it will not go into the classroom. It will go to administration.
That's correct.
And there's a point where that is so true. I mean,
and it's not the fault of the administration. This is where it gets tough, because we've got administrators. A lot of them are trying just as hard as they can to do
Certainly.
It too, but they have a regulatory requirement to meet based on a law, which means you have to have people whose only job is to make sure that these regulatory requirements got met. Well, that means that they are no longer primarily focused on
teaching.
Our whole concept, when the federal government gets involved and says, you will do this and we will have a standard that must be met, what it does is it sets a standardized person that comes out of the system.
We're
not even doing that very well.
There's a backside to that we, for the sake of balance, I think is worth discussing. And that is the largest for-profit, unregulated university system in the United States, the Phoenix system, or for that matter, Trump University,
right,
took in a lot of federal money, a lot of students' loans, and then produced people that weren't educated.
Right.
Because there isn't a federal standard. Now, the big plus to our university system is there's not a federal standard.
Right, there's accreditation.
But they were accredited. But the point is, the accreditation system basically says, and I hate to put it this way, how much money you got.
Right.
And if you got enough money, we'll accredit you. We'll figure some way to accredit you. The other, you know, and basically learning how to play that system so that you get accreditation, but you're really not teaching. And to add to that, even something like the University of Texas, which is a great institution, still gives degrees to people who have, and in master's degrees and so on, who have borrowed virtually all the money they used to get the education.
Right.
And they give degrees that they are quite confident there's no job in.
Right.
And asking an 18-year-old kid to borrow
$180,000.
Yes, and I've actually seen $200,000 student debts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
To become, for example, an attorney, only to realize that there are a heck of a lot more new attorneys being pumped out of the schools across the country than there are jobs for those new attorneys. And we've had people at our business when we've advertised for openings who come in, and we're willing to pay a very good wage relative to the local economy here in Central Texas.
They can't take it because they've got student loans that are so big that they wouldn't be able to survive.
Right. And my youngest daughter, his youngest sibling, which is coincidental. I think that's interesting. We need to work on analyzing that.
Everything's relative.
Right. Has friends who have master's degrees
and there's jobs available for them. But the problem is they're entry-level master degree jobs. And when they look at the amount of wages that they receive combined with the expense of living in New York or Austin or wherever they can find the job to use their master's degree, a combination of the student debt and the rent leaves them in the hole.
Yeah.
And that is just we've got a lot of, so there's a backside to this too. The front side is, yeah, the free enterprise system and the market has to have an effect here. The backside to it is, whoops, if we allow totally untrammeled, unregulated the free enterprise system, we wind up with a bunch of people out there with more debt that they can pay and not able to get a job.
Now, having said all of that, in Temple, they've had a program for years now where the Temple High School folks get to work with the doctors out mm-hmm. at Scott and White and begin the process of going up through medical school.
And that works.
And that works really well. I would really love to see institutions begin to work together, upper-level institutions taking up with the lower-level institutions and combining their efforts to produce the end result that we want. And that includes technical institutions as well as any other institution. We need to be able to customize to the student in a way that challenges the student into being the best at what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then defining how to make money doing that.
Not just what they want to do, but what they want to do that's liable to get them a good employment.
Right. And then, well, in most cases, you can find a way of making money doing what you want to do. Seriously, you can.
Yeah, in most cases. But there are certainly people out there with master's degrees in things that they can't ever make a living.
Correct.
They're flipping hamburgers someplace, and that's an endangered species right now.
Yeah, hamburger flipping is going to be something computers do in the not-too-distant future, and by that I mean it's happening already right now. It's just not everywhere yet.
The bottom line, I think, this is Jeff, to this, is that our school system, public school system, is no longer adequately designed or structured to meet the needs of the 21st century. And it's going to take something major because the federal government funds it the way it is, and the regulations insist that it stay the way it is, and the state school boards insist that they stay the way it is, and we'll just tinker with it.
If they receive federal money.
Well, even at the state level, there's this tremendous reluctance to change anything because, again, coming at it from the other side, the teachers' unions don't want to change anything.
Right. And very clearly, this is extremely clear. The state has the right, Texas has the right, to set the law that says you're allowed to use vouchers.
Yes.
The reason why they haven't is because it will have a negative impact, a very real and measurable negative impact on the existing schools.
Yes.
If you're in a public school, the quality will drop.
Well, in some cases.
Because the amount of money coming into that system will go down.
Well, if vouchers are allowed, and I can, and I've got kids, and I see that the school across town is a better school than the one locally that's in my neighborhood.
Right.
I can take the vouchers and move them across town. I don't know that whether there will be enough, and we do have to have accreditation. I don't know if enough charter schools will spring up. Here's the point: we do need a debate on this. We do need we do need a shakeup of the system. Frankly, there's two institutions in the United States that worry me: the public education system and the healthcare system. If you just allow both of them to run on the way they are,
we're going to be broken.
We'll run into a major crisis, and we'll react to the major crisis.
Let me give you some other numbers to back that up. Those same earlier in the hour, I was talking about the top 100 schools. 85 of them are in the United States. If you go to any one of those schools, you'll find that a large percentage of the undergraduate student body is from overseas. That's not a bad thing. They're coming in. We're bringing in the geniuses from overseas to come here and likely to stay here and to keep helping us innovate. At the graduate level and above, a year and a half ago, we hit a point where the majority of the top institutions' graduate level students are from foreign countries. They're coming in on the H-1B visa. That's the genius visa. It's amazing. It's great. We're bringing in the geniuses from everywhere else. We're keeping most of them.
And they're bringing their money in, too.
And they're bringing their money in. We're keeping most of them, but some of them go back. And when they go back, they set up direct competition to the United States. All of that is great that we're bringing in these people, but if we're not educating our own to be in those same levels of education, mm-hmm. we're doing what the Roman Empire did. The Roman Empire fell from within. They got so used to everyone wanting to come and be a part of Rome that everybody came and was a part of Rome, and they educated everyone. They taught them all their secrets, and then they left. And those were the people that led the armies coming back to invade Rome. And I don't think it's exactly the same in history as now. But
yeah,
I do know –
there's
other
factors.
There's a lot of other factors. But I do know that if we don't raise the quality with which we treat – the education of our kids, then we're going to begin to lag the world. And we're going to begin to be behind in a country that is leading.
And this, when I mentioned the healthcare system, if you look at the resources that are being devoted to the public education system and the management of those resources, you may say, well, you know, we're giving more and more money. No, actually, the percentage of gross domestic product going to the public schools is shrinking. Why is it shrinking? Largely because we can't afford to give the money to the public schools because our health care costs have risen so much that it takes such a big chunk out of what everybody's doing. And I'm going to tell you something as an investor and a management of investments. This is kind of contrary to what most people will say. If you look at the profitability, the earnings of healthcare-related private companies in the United States, particularly the pharmaceutical industry, you will be quite amazed to see that they have very large profit margins. They're making a lot of money, and an argument can be made. I'm not sure that because we really need somebody to present the other side who's thought about this. But we're seeing money decrease going into public education and increase going into healthcare, and it's winding up at the bottom line of Pfizer or
right.
Glaxo Welcome, which is a British company.
Right. GlaxoSmithKline. Yeah.
GlaxoSmithKline Welcome and a whole
right.
bunch of other stuff.
The idea here, and when you look at, by the way, the insurance company's bottom lines, the health insurance companies, when they're dealing with health insurance, their margins are razor thin. Then you go over and you look at the pharmaceutical companies, and their margins are fat and juicy.
And they managed to, very frankly, for instance, they managed to lobby Congress so that Medicare cannot do what your local hospital can do. Medicare can't go in and bargain with a pharmaceutical company for the lowest price. They have to accept whatever the pharmaceutical company feels like charging them.
And that was done.
And that's a law.
That was done under George W. Bush.
With a Republican Congress.
Right. And there are some real issues that we've got to deal with going forward, and that's one of them. When Congress is calling CEOs of pharmaceutical companies to sit in front of them and talk to them about why they can increase their the cost of their drugs by 700%.
And Congress passed a law authorizing it.
Yeah. That's really what it comes down to. The CEO will sit there and say, yes, you may think that's unethical, but my obligation is to my shareholder.
Mm-hmm.
My obligation is not to give a cheap product. My obligation is to make money for my shareholders.
And their biggest customer is Medicare or Medicaid.
Right.
And Medicare or Medicaid is forbidden to do any bargaining to lower the price.
It's Medicare for the prescription drug benefit package mm-hmm. that comes with the
right. So it really, I think, I think what you're seeing here is there's a lot of things that need to be shaken up. And as much as many people may not like the logical train that Donald Trump exudes in his tweets, one of the reasons he won is because things do need to be shaken up. We can't tweak things at this point and expect to get a better result.
We need to change some major systems. Whether or not Donald Trump is the one to do it is something we have to wait and see.
Yep. but we are going to get an opportunity to see.
Well, we've got some commercials to play, and we'll be back on the other end. If you would like to call us in here, it appears that our phone system is fixed. It's the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side of these messages.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers in here have not changed. We're still in the area code 254, and the telephone number is 773-1400. We've got about 15 minutes left in the Personal Wealth Coach radio program, second hour, and then we're going to be out of here for a week, so this is your last opportunity to harass us.
All right. Well, I've got an email harassment right now.
Okay, good.
The question is from Neil. Where do the lights go when they're out?
Where do the lights go when they're out?
Well, they lost the race. The speed of light is slower than the speed of dark because dark gets there first.
Now, where does the light go, or where do the lights? Is it plural or singular?
Where do the lights go when lights. They're out? The lights are out. People say that, but nobody says where they are. This is a deep conversation.
I think they're in Georgia. When the lights went out in Georgia?
Yeah, that could be it. They went to Georgia.
Yeah, that's it. So I guess they go on vacation to Georgia when they go out.
Right.
I don't know. It's one of those things we need to look at. I know where the lights are from, but I don't know where they're going.
The other part of that email is that the listener is glad you're fully back and in good health. He appreciates everything that we guys do. I'm not sure he appreciates everything that we do.
Well,
I mean,
he said so we need to take him at his word.
I will.
Anyway, that was cool. And by the way,
thanks for the email.
The email is jake@tpwc.com. And, oh, got a little more bagpipe there. You know, there's a lot going on in the economy right now. The economy seems to be gaining speed. Employment is up. Unemployment is down. There's always going to be some people who complain about that and say, well, it's really not as good as it looks. But I can tell you with some degree of – I can make a forecast that is very highly probable to be correct, and that is that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates next week.
I have a great deal of belief that that will happen.
And last year, when they were thinking just barely they might under some circumstances, if the wind blew in the right direction and the rain fell and everything worked out perfectly, they might raise interest rates a little bit. The market went into a nosedive. This year, when they raise interest rates a little bit, the market will probably go up, and it will be a non-event. And the reason it's a non-event is interest rates are already up. The Fed is now in the position where they've got to catch up with the market.
I'm going to read a little snippet from Ben Bernanke here about this, and you're going to like this. Ben Bernanke is a distinguished fellow at the Brookings Institute,
and
now.
An exceptionally handsome man.
He
particularly
looks
his beard and his head and everything.
Very much
right.
Like Jeff McClure. He's just
He's just an exceptionally handsome man.
He writes up. He's got his blog there at the Brookings Institute. I realize probably only followed by geeks like us, but I read it on a regular basis. And this little write-up will explain why it's hard to predict what the Federal Reserve will do when their Federal Open Market Committee meets. This is what happens. This is the snippet. Four times each year, just prior to a Federal Open Market Committee meeting, the 19 Federal Open Market Committee participants, there's 7 board governors when there are no vacancies, 12 Reserve Bank presidents.
Are they excited rather than bored?
I don't think that they're excited almost by definition.
Okay.
Well, dreary scientists of the dreary scientists.
Well, the first 7 are bored, so that's okay.
Right. Okay. They submit projections, these 17 folks, and by 17 folks, each of those people has a whole massive team of people that have percolated information upward rather than downward to these folks to give at this. So they present key economic variables, projections for these variables, for real output growth, the unemployment rate, overall inflation, and core inflation, excluding prices of food and energy, and for short-term interest rates. They cover the current year and up to 3 additional years into the future. Projections are also made for the long-run values of the variables. Okay.
That is excessively geeky.
Okay. That's why they're hard to predict. We can look around and say we've got a lot of data that we've gathered, and we say, based on the data that I have, it's probably a good idea for the Federal Reserve to raise their interest rates. I thought they were going to do it in October because they had one bit of information. There was a big speed bump. In September, we had the unemployment numbers come back a little bit scary. 1 week came back a little bit scary, and it put them off, which means that they've been very carefully approaching this next interest rate hike. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty certain, but I have to be careful about that because there were a lot of polls that said that they were very certain that Hillary Clinton would be elected. I think, from my educated opinion, that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates in December.
My educated opinion is based on the fact that the voting members make speeches.
Yes, and that's one of the problems that he addresses in his blog, by the way. It's not just the voting members that makes – everybody's making speeches these days.
The trick is to look at what the voting members – and it's called the dots, by the way, connecting the dots. If you look at what the voting members of the Federal Reserve, the ones who actually – whose votes actually count of the 17, you will discover that none of them are arguing at this point against raising interest rates, and – all the ones that have expressed an opinion on it are for raising interest rates.
It's going to happen.
So if there's no opposition being voiced and a lot of people in favor of raising interest rates, they're going to raise interest rates.
Now, that whole blog had to do with exactly what you just said, which is listening to the different speeches that are being made by the different people that are involved here. Mm-hmm. Because in not that long ago, the Federal Reserve not only didn't tell you what they were going to decide, they didn't even tell you after it was done. You had to find it yourself.
We've gotten a lot more transparent, right, which is in some ways a good thing, in some ways not. But
the transparency here shows that there are a lot of conflicting opinions that come together, and when they come close to being unanimous, a decision is made.
Yep.
And that's a really good system to have in place, to have a lot of very well-educated people talking about it in a non-political format, saying this is what is probably going to be best for the economy. And when I say probably, they don't say probably, most likely. Generally speaking, they have a lot of other words that mean probably, that fill up a whole paragraph that mean probably.
In our humble opinion, they don't say humble opinion.
No, they
in
don't.
Our, in the opinion of the Federal Reserve Board, the predominance of data suggests that a slight increase in the interbank lending rate may be beneficial to the overall economy to prevent incipient inflation from occurring.
And you can replace that all with probably good for the economy.
Yeah, but all those people who write those press releases wouldn't have anything to write.
Right.
And all the people who analyze every word in the press release.
They have to write that in that way to cover all the bases, because the media gets so persnickety and other economists get so persnickety. They want to hit every single word and say, you didn't cover this. You didn't put an L-Y at the end of this word.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which brings up another subject I wanted to touch on before we leave.
Excellent.
And that is the fact that President Trump, when he becomes President Trump, President-elect Trump, will probably not have news conferences. He doesn't do news conferences.
He's had one since the election.
And
he didn't have very many during the election.
He doesn't like people to ask him questions. He'd rather tweet. And that is a trend that is irritating the news media, but it is a fact that sound bites have become the news. And what this does is it puts previously the responsibility was on the reporters and the editors to filter this stuff out and give it meaning and a meaningful story. But the speed with which we expect them to hit us with a headline, and the headlines will determine how many clicks they get, and the clicks they get will determine how much money they make, have resulted in a situation where we often see a sensational headline
and even a sensational open to the story. And then further, if you dig down in a responsible journalistic story, you will find out that all that stuff we said above probably isn't true. So get used to the fact that you're going to get a tweet. We're in a tweet environment. 144 characters is the news. But here's the thing. The responsibility, just like with the school systems we're talking about, ultimately falls back on us to check out the reality, the evidence behind that tweet news statement.
Right. We had a big kerfluffle in the last couple of days. I just like that word. Where China's upset because President-elect Trump received a call from the head of the Taiwanese government.
The president.
The president. Saying congratulations on your win.
And he said congratulations back on your recent win.
Right. And the tweet that Donald Trump put out there was why is everybody upset? They called me.
And they also said – he also had a second tweet on that. Did you see that?
Yeah.
He said we can sell him $168 million worth of
– Billion.
Billion dollars worth of armament, but I can't talk to him?
And unfortunately, that is the state of diplomacy that – it's just like negotiation. It's just on a different scale, and he's got to get that part in, that negotiations on a diplomatic scale are just like negotiations at a business scale. The CEO doesn't call up to order a ream of paper.
But the CEO can talk to the other CEO.
Unless the CEO has told another CEO that we're not talking to that CEO.
I'm going to make a guess here. I don't have any real evidence on this. I'm just going to make a guess. I have this, at least hope, that this wasn't a blunder. This was a strategic move, I'm hoping. And let me explain why I think so. Donald Trump was personally offended, and you could tell it if you followed him at the time, at the treatment President Obama got in Air Force One when he
right.
last flew to China. He
yeah.
was clearly
no
insulted.
No red carpet. Yeah, and
he had
to
come
get out
of the belly of the airplane, and they couldn't get a stairway up, but they could get the cameras.
That means something very clear in Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
And coming out of the belly of the aircraft is a statement. It's like
it
being a snake.
Basically, your poop.
Yeah.
And he said he would have said, okay, you won't allow me to walk downstairs with red carpet. I'm going back to the United States. Now, that would have been a diplomatic, terrible thing and would cause the Chinese to supposedly be insulted.
But no different than when the president of the Philippines called Obama the son of a whore and Obama didn't meet with him. It's a good mm-hmm. diplomatic tool. Okay, you're going to insult me as soon as I show up. I'm leaving.
I'm going to hope here that the issue is if you're going to insult the president of the United States and expect us to be nice and not talk to the president of Taiwan, well, guess what? It isn't going to cause a nuclear war for me to talk to the president of Taiwan. It's an insult to you, but you threw an insult at us. Now, don't do that to me because I can do it back to you worse.
Right.
I'm hoping that the negotiator Trump just made a move.
That I would hope that because the Chinese have done some things. They're on the foreign policy scene, Barack Obama has been weak, extremely weak.
Yes. He's a pacifist.
He has not led the world. In fact, he's been pushed around by the world. And I don't expect that to happen under Donald Trump.
No, not with the Secretary of Defense that he named, who I sincerely hope Congress will pass an amendment to the law to allow to become Secretary of Defense, because it's one thing both the Democrats and the Republicans seem to like the Secretary of Defense nominee.
We really are almost out of time, but that law is there to prevent the kind of leadership in the Army taking political,
sure.
and that's a very, very real need, and we can't forget about it. Mm-hmm. It's like removing some of the regulations on banks. We have to be careful and know why we did it before we take it off.
But it's important to note that General Marshall became Secretary of State rather rapidly after retiring as a 5-star
right.
general.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, we're about out of time for this week. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the weekend, real live people during the week. We give advice to people with high net worth on how to invest and what they should do with their money and talk to them about business and all kinds of other good stuff. If you would like to reach that number locally,
it's area code 254, of course, and it's a hard number to remember, 947-1111.
And you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us, Jake@tpwc.com or Jeff@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We have lots of good stuff on there. We've got some horrible stuff, too. You can listen to more of our radio program, and it's just remember to take your medication. It has been shown to science has been shown to cause cancer in rats, so keep that in mind.
I love it. Until next week.
This has been the Personal Wealth Coach, and we thank you very much for your listening and patience in having us on the air.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.